Ozzie called Jake just after midnight and awakened him from a deep sleep. 15 minutes later, Ozzie stopped in front of the house, and Jake hustled outside and into the sheriff's car. The ice was worse, and the streets were slick, and as they crept through town, Ozzie gave an update. The second boy was still in surgery, but things looked grim. As far as Ozzie could tell at that point, Simeon had not been drinking in a local honky-tonk. According to Letty, who was already at the hospital, he had not been home in over a week. She thought he was returning from a long haul, though he was not carrying cash or a paycheck. He had a broken nose, but was otherwise unhurt.
"The drunks always walk away from their wrecks," Ozzie said.
They found Letty and Portia hiding at the end of a long hallway, not far from Simeon's room. Both were crying, distraught, almost inconsolable. Jake sat with them while Ozzie left to check on other matters. After a few minutes with little conversation, Letty walked away to find a restroom. As soon as she was gone, Portia said,
10 years ago, I was 14 and in the 9th grade, and I begged her to leave him. He was hitting her back then. I saw it. I said, please, Mama, let's get away from him. Go somewhere else. I think maybe she tried, but she's always been afraid of him. Now look what he's done. What'll happen to him, Jake?
She raked tears off her cheeks with the back of her hand. Barely above a whisper, Jake said,
nothing good. Assuming everything is his fault and that he was drunk, he's looking at vehicular homicide. One count as of now.
What's it carry?
5 to 25. The judge has a lot of discretion.
And he can't get out of it?
No, I see no way.
Hallelujah. He'll finally be gone for a long time.
She cupped both hands over her mouth and nose and sobbed harder.
Those poor boys,
she kept saying. The crowd continued to grow around the waiting area on the hospital's main wing. Ozzie spoke to Jeff and Evelyn Roston, the parents, who were too stunned to say much. He talked to one of the boys' uncles and explained that Simeon Lang was in custody and would be moved to the jail within hours. Yes, he was drunk. Still is. I'm very sorry.
You better get him out of here,
the uncle said, nodding to a group of men nearby. Angry, distraught men, rural types, raised around guns and rifles, and upset enough to do something drastic. Others joined them. The Rostons grew soybeans and chickens and were active in their country church. They had many relatives and friends, and they had never voted for Ozzie. Every deputy on the payroll was at the hospital by 2 a.m. At 3, they sneaked Simeon out of the hospital and took him to jail. Ozzie informed the uncle. Letty and Portia used the same side door and left the hospital. Jake accompanied them to their car. He returned to the main wing, avoided the waiting area, and found Ozzie chatting with two of his men. Dumas Lee approached them, camera around his neck, and they immediately went silent. Dumas said,
"Say, Jake, you got a minute?"
Jake hesitated, looked at Ozzie, who said,
"No comment whatsoever."
Then asked Dumas,
"What's on your mind?"
"Just a couple of questions."
They walked away side by side down a long corridor. Dumas asked,
"Can you confirm it's Simeon Lang?"
It was senseless to deny it, so Jake said, "Yes."
"And you're his lawyer?"
"I am not."
"Okay, but he's had a drunk driving charge pending in city court for 4 months. Your name's on the docket as his lawyer."
"Careful," Jake warned himself. He breathed deeply and felt a thick knot in his stomach. "I did that as a favor," he said.
"I don't care why you did it. Your name's on the docket as his lawyer."
"I'm not his lawyer, okay? Never have been.
I can't represent the estate of Seth Hubbard and also represent Simeon Lang, the husband of one of the beneficiaries. Then why did you show up in court on October 19th to request a postponement of his drunk driving case? It was a favor. I'm not his lawyer, okay, Dumas? Why has the case been postponed for 4 months? I'm not the judge. I'll talk to him later, Dumas fired back. You do that. No further comment. Jake abruptly turned around and walked away. Dumas followed and kept talking, saying, "Look, Jake, you better talk to me because this is going to look bad." Jake turned around again, and they squared off in the center of the corridor. Jake caught himself, took a deep breath, and said, "Don't draw any conclusions, Dumas. I haven't touched the DUI case in 4 months because I'm not his lawyer. If you will recall, at the time, he was represented by those clowns from Memphis, not by me. So please, be careful here." Dumas was scribbling furiously. Jake wanted to punch him. Everything was suddenly forgotten by screams from the other end of the building. Bo Roston was pronounced dead at 4:15 a.m. Chapter 29. Jake and Carla sat at the kitchen table and waited for the coffee to brew. It was not yet 5 a.m. on Wednesday, February 22nd, a day that would undoubtedly be one of the saddest and darkest in the county's history. Two teenagers, bright kids, strong students, athletes, church members, popular boys from a good family, slaughtered on an icy road by a drunk. The horrible news was spreading by the minute. The cafes would be packed as the early risers hurried in for the latest word. The churches would open for prayer. Clanton High School would be the worst place to be. Those poor kids. Carla poured coffee, and they spoke softly, in hushed tones, so Hannah wouldn't be awakened. Jake was saying, "I never opened a file. Ozzie called me on Monday, told me Simeon was arrested on Saturday morning and was due in court on Wednesday. When he sobered up, Ozzie drove him home and along the way told him to get rid of the Memphis lawyers. I thanked Ozzie and we agreed to meet later. He called back and asked if I would show up in court Wednesday to get the case continued. Ozzie thought he could use the DUI to pressure Simeon to get in line. I went to court that Wednesday, did the paperwork, asked for a continuance, got one, and forgot about it, for the most part. At the time, Simeon was still represented by Booker Sistrunk, and I told Simeon in court that I would not help him with the DUI. I didn't like the guy. In fact, I despised him." "Did you see a conflict?" Carla asked. "I thought about it. In fact, I even mentioned it to Ozzie. The truth was, there was no conflict. I'm the attorney for the estate. Simeon is not an interested party in the estate. His wife is, but he's not."
"That's not real clear, Jake."
"No, it's not. And I should not have gotten involved. It was a huge mistake. I didn't trust my instincts."
"But no one can blame you for Simeon's drunk driving."
"Sure they can. If the case had been handled properly, he would have been convicted before now and his license pulled. He would not have been driving last night, in theory anyway. The truth is, half the blacks and rednecks in this county do not have valid licenses."
"It's only 4 months, Jake. These cases drag on for longer, don't they?"
"Sometimes."
"What was that guy's name? The roofer? You did a DUI for his son, and the case lasted a year."
"Chuck Bennett, but I didn't want the boy in jail until they finished with our roof."
"My point is that these cases can drag on."
"Sure, but there's always finger-pointing after a tragedy. The blame game. And since I'm in the Lang camp, I'll get my share. It's always easy to blame the lawyers. Ozzie'll get hammered, too. He'll be seen as the black sheriff trying to protect one of his own, and now two white kids are dead. It could be brutal.
Maybe not, Jake.
I'm not optimistic.
How will it affect the will contest?
Jake slowly sipped his coffee and stared through a window into the blackness of his backyard. Softly, he said, "It's devastating. Simeon Lang will be the most reviled person in this county for months to come. He'll have his day in court, then get sent away to prison. Over time, he'll be forgotten by most folks. But our trial is only 6 weeks away. The Lang name is toxic. Imagine trying to pick a jury with that baggage." He took another sip, then rubbed his eyes. "Letty has no choice but to file for divorce, and quickly. She has to cut all ties to Simeon."
"Will she?"
"Why not? He'll spend the next 20 or 30 years in Parchman, where he belongs."
"I'm sure the Rostons will be pleased with that."
"Those poor people."
"Are you seeing her today, Letty?"
"I'm sure I will. I'll call Harry Rex first thing this morning and try to arrange a meeting. He'll know what to do."
"Will this make the Times?"
"No. The Times will be on the street in an hour. I'm sure Dumas will give it the entire front page next week, with photos of the wrecked vehicles, as much gore as possible. And he'd love to grind me up, too."
"What's the worst he can say about you, Jake?"
"Well, first he can label me as Simeon's lawyer. Then he can slant and twist and imply that I've somehow stalled the October DUI case, and that if I had not done so, then Simeon's driver's license would have been yanked by the court and he wouldn't be driving. Thus, the Roston boys wouldn't be dead."
"He can't do that. That's assuming far too much."
"He can and he will."
"Then talk to him. Damage control here, Jake. Today is Wednesday, so the funerals will probably be over the weekend. Wait until Monday and file the divorce. What do you call that restraining thing?"
"TRO, temporary restraining order."
"That's it. Get the judge to sign one of those so Simeon can't get near Letty. Sure, he's in jail, but if she wants a TRO, it makes her look good. A clean break. She's running from the guy. In the meantime, talk to Dumas and make sure he gets the facts straight. Do some research and show him that some DUI cases drag on for more than 4 months. You never opened a file, and you certainly weren't paid a dime. See if you can convince Ozzie to take some heat. If I recall correctly, he got about 70% of the vote the last time he ran. He's bulletproof. Plus, he wants Letty to win the will contest. If you're getting hit with baggage, get Ozzie to shoulder some. He can handle it."
Jake was nodding along, even smiling. "Go, girl."
She said, "Look, dear, right now you're shell-shocked and you're scared. Shake it off. You've done nothing wrong, so don't get blamed for anything. Control the damage. Then control the spin.
Can I hire you? My office needs some help.
You can't afford me. I'm a school teacher."
Hannah was coughing. Carla went to check on her. The real damage control began about an hour later, when Jake stormed into the coffee shop, ready to convince one and all that he was not the lawyer for Simeon Lang, and never had been. So many rumors began there, over eggs and bacon. In the shower, Jake decided to go straight to the source. Marshall Prather was there in uniform, behind a stack of pancakes, waiting, it seemed. He had been up all night, too, and looked as bleary-eyed as Jake. During the lull that was caused by Jake's entry, Marshall said,
"Hey, Jake, saw you at the hospital a few hours ago."
This was a deliberate effort to start the spin because Ozzie was also controlling damage.
"Yeah, just awful," Jake said somberly. At full volume, he asked, Did y'all take Lang to jail?
Yep. He's still sobering up.
You his lawyer, Jake?
Asked Ken Nugent from three tables over. Nugent drove the Pepsi truck and spent his days hauling cases of beverages into country stores. Dell had once said, in his absence, that no one spread more gossip than Nugent.
Never have been, Jake said. I don't represent him, nor do I represent his wife.
What the hell you doing in the case, then? Nugent fired back.
Dell poured coffee into Jake's cup and bumped him with her rear end, part of the routine.
Morning, sweetie, she whispered.
Jake smiled at her, then looked back at Nugent. Things were mute as all other conversations stopped. Jake said, Under the law, I actually represent Mr. Seth Hubbard, who's no longer with us, of course. But just before he died, he selected me as the attorney for his estate. My job is to follow his wishes, present his last will, and protect his estate. My contract of representation is with the administrator of the estate, and no one else. Not Letty Lang, and certainly not her husband. Frankly, I can't stand the guy. Don't forget, he hired those Memphis clowns who tried to steal the case. Dell, always loyal, piped in.
That's what I tried to tell him.
She placed Jake's toast and grits in front of him.
So who's his lawyer? Nugent asked, ignoring her.
I have no idea. Probably one appointed by the court. I doubt if he can afford his own.
What will he get? Jake asked Roy Kern, a plumber who had worked on Jake's previous home.
A lot. 2 counts of vehicular homicide at 5 to 25 a pop.
Don't know how it'll go down, but Judge Noose is tough in these cases. I wouldn't be surprised if he got 20 or 30 years.
Why not the death penalty? Asked Nugent.
It's not a death case because the hell it ain't. You got 2 dead kids.
There was no deliberate effort to kill. Nothing premeditated. A death penalty case requires murder plus something else. Murder plus rape. Murder plus robbery. Murder plus kidnapping. This could never be a death case. This was not well received by the crowd. When stirred up, the gang at the coffee shop could resemble the beginnings of a lynch mob, but it always settled down after breakfast. Jake sprinkled Tabasco on his grits and began buttering his toast. Nugent asked,
Can the Rossins get any of the money?
The money? As if Seth's estate were now available and thus vulnerable. Jake laid down his fork and looked at Nugent. He reminded himself that these were his people, his clients and friends, and they just needed reassuring. They did not understand the ins and outs of the law and of probate, and they were concerned that an injustice might be in the works.
No, Jake said pleasantly. There's no way.
It will be months, probably years, before Mr. Hubbard's money is finally disbursed. And as of right now, we really don't know who'll get it. The trial will help settle things, but its verdict will certainly be appealed. And even if Letty Lang eventually gets all the money, or 90% of it, her husband doesn't get a dime. He'll be locked away anyway. The Rostons will not have the right to make a claim against Letty. He took a bite of toast and chewed quickly. He wanted to control the spin and not waste time with his mouth full.
He won't get out on bond, will he, Jake? Asked Bill West.
I doubt it. A bond will be set, but it'll probably be too high. My guess is he'll stay in jail until he either pleads under an agreement or goes to trial.
What kind of defense could he use?
Jake shook his head as if there could be no defense. He was drunk, and there's an eyewitness, right, Marshal?
Yep, guy saw it all.
Jake continued, I see a plea bargain and a long sentence.
Ain't he got a boy in prison?
Asked Nugent.
He does,
Marvis.
Maybe he can bunk with his boy,
join the same gang. Have all sorts of fun at Parchman,
Nugent said and got some laughs. Jake laughed too, then attacked his breakfast. He was relieved. The conversation had moved away from any connection he might have to Simeon Lang. They would leave the coffee shop and go to their jobs, where all day long they would talk about nothing but the Roston tragedy. And they would have the inside scoop because they had had breakfast with Jake, the man in the middle. They would assure their co-workers and listeners that their pal Jake was not the lawyer for Simeon Lang, the most hated man in Ford County. They would assuage their fears and promise them that Lang was headed to prison for a long time. Jake had told them so. Bright early morning sunlight streamed through the wooden blinds and fell into neat white rows across the long conference room table. Somewhere in the background, a phone rang constantly, but no one had any interest in answering it. The front door was locked, and every 15 minutes or so, there was a knock. The tense discussions rose, then ebbed and waned, and finally ceased, though there was so much more to say. Harry Rex had walked them through the strategies of a divorce filing. File now, file loudly, file loaded with as many sordid allegations as possible to make Mr. Lang appear to be the creep he really was. Allege adultery, habitual, cruel, and inhuman treatment, desertion, drunkenness, abuse, non-support. Throw in everything, because the marriage is over whether Letty would admit it or not. Pound him, because he cannot respond from jail, and why would he bother anyway? Do it Monday, and make sure Dumas Lee and every other reporter with even a passing interest gets a copy of the filing. Include a request for a restraining order to keep the lout off the property and away from Letty and the kids and grandkids for the rest of their lives. It's about ending a bad marriage, but it's also about posturing for the public. Harry Rex agreed to handle the case. Portia had told them the first threatening phone call came just after 5 a.m. Phaedra took it, and after a few seconds calmly hung up.
"He called me a nigger," she said, stunned. "Said we'll pay for killing those boys."
They panicked and locked the doors. Portia found a handgun in a closet and loaded it. They turned off the lights and huddled together in the den, watching the street. Then the phone rang again and again. They prayed for sunrise. She said her mother would sign the divorce papers. But once she does, look out for the Langs. Simeon's brothers and cousins were notorious lowlifes, same gene pool, and they would cause trouble. They've been pestering Letty for money anyway, and if they think they're getting cut out, they'll do something stupid. Lucian had had a rough night, but he was there nonetheless and thinking as clearly as ever. He quickly took the position that the trial over the will must not be held in Ford County. Jake had no choice but to request a change of venue, which Attlee would probably deny, but at the very least, it would give them a strong argument on appeal. Lucian had never been excited about Jake's chances of winning before a jury, and he had long been convinced the pool had been contaminated by Booker Sistrunk. Letty's ill-advised decision to move to town and into a home once owned by a slightly prominent white family had not helped her standing in the community. There was already resentment and plenty of suspicion. She was not working, and had not worked since Hubbard died. And now this. Now she had the most hated name in the county. Filing for divorce was not even an option. It had to be done. But the divorce could not possibly be finished by the time the trial started on April 3rd. Her name was Lang in the will. It was Lang now, and it would be Lang during the trial. Put him, Lucian, in Wade Lanier's shoes, and he would have the jury loathing every Lang who ever lived.
"Sorry, Portia," Lucian said. "No offense. That's just the way it would be."
She understood, or at least tried to. She was too exhausted to say much. She had left her mother and sisters wrapped in their bathrobes, huddled by the fireplace, with the gun on the mantel, wondering whether they should send the children to school and what they should tell them. Kirk, a sophomore at Clanton High, knew the Roston boys and was swearing he would never return to the school. They were such nice boys, and he hated his father. His life was over. He wanted to get away, like Portia, join the army and never come back. Jake and Harry Rex had discussed ways to postpone the trial, drag it out, burn some clock, give Harry Rex enough time to get the divorce final, give the system enough time to dispose of Simeon and ship him away, and give the county some distance between the horror of the moment, the two burials, and the fight over the estate of Seth Hubbard. Where would they all be in 6 months? Letty would be divorced. She could even adopt her old name, Letty Tabor. It sounded much better, though Portia reminded herself she would still be stuck with Lang. Simeon would be gone. Sistrunk would be all but forgotten. Surely things would be more conducive to a fair trial in 6 months. His opponents would object vociferously, and with such momentum on their side, why not? Jake was slightly optimistic he could have a chat with Judge Attlee, perhaps another late Friday afternoon meeting on the porch with Whiskey Sours, and after the edge was knocked off, he could broach the notion of a delay or change of venue. It was worth a try. The only downside was the risk of angering the judge by such an overt attempt at earwigging. And what would the judge do other than to tell Jake to shut up? He wouldn't do that, not after a couple of Whiskey Sours. He might not like the conversation, but he would never chastise Jake. A slight scolding, maybe, but nothing close to permanent damage. "Let some time pass," Jake said. "Let the rage and horror and sadness lose some of their sting, then die down." They would file the divorce on Monday, and in a week or so, Jake would approach Judge Attlee. Quince Lundy arrived for one of two weekly visits. He found them in the conference room, gathered glumly around the table, quiet, subdued, almost mournful, as they stared at the walls and looked at a bleak future. He had heard the news on the Clanton radio station as he drove over from Smithfield. He wanted to ask what the tragedy meant for the trial, but after a few moments in the conference room, he suspected the trial was in serious trouble. Willie Hastings was one of four black deputies on Ozzie's staff. His cousin was Gwen Haley, wife of Carl Lee, mother of Tanya, who was now 13 years old and doing well. He knocked on the front door of the Sappington house and waited as he heard feet shuffling hurriedly inside. Finally, the door cracked, and Letty peeked through it. Willie said,
"Morning, Miss Lang. Sheriff Wall sent me over."
The door opened wider, and she managed to smile.
"That you, Willie?" she said. "Would you like to come in?"
He entered and found the children in the den, watching television, obviously skipping school. He followed Letty to the kitchen, where Fidra fixed him a cup of coffee. He chatted with the women, made some notes about the threatening calls, noticed the phone was now off the hook, and said he would hang around for a while. He was parked in the driveway and would stay there in case they needed him, and to show a presence. Sheriff Wald sends his regrets. Simeon was in a cell by himself, pretty banged up, and still sleeping off his booze. Hastings did not know the Rostons, and had not spoken with them. but he understood they were at home, surrounded by family and friends. Letty handed him a letter she had written during the early morning and asked if he could make sure it was delivered to the Rostons.
"Just our way of saying how awful we feel," she said.
Willie promised to have it in their hands before noon. They topped off his coffee, and he went outside. The temperature was still below freezing, but the heater worked well in his patrol car. Throughout the morning, he sipped coffee, watched the street, saw nothing, and tried to stay awake. An early news show on the Tupelo station ran the story at 7 a.m. Stillman Rush was in the shower and missed it, but an associate did not. Phone calls were made, details verified, and an hour later, Stillman called Wade Lanier in Jackson with the tragic but also promising news. Lightning had struck. No juror in Ford County would ever have a shot at Simeon Lang, but his wife had just become an easy target. Chapter 30. Early Thursday morning, Simeon Lang was awakened, fed, handcuffed, and escorted out of his cell and down a hallway to a cramped meeting room where a stranger was waiting. He sat in a folding chair, still handcuffed, and listened as the stranger said,
"My name is Arthur Welch, and I'm a lawyer from Clarksdale over in the Delta."
"I know where Clarksdale is," Simeon said.
He had a large bandage taped across his nose. His left eye was shut with stitches around the edge.
"Good for you," Welch said. "I'm here to represent you because no one else will take the case. You have a first appearance and bail hearing this morning at 9, and you'll need a lawyer."
"Why are you here?"
"A friend asked me to be here, okay?" "That's all you need to know. Right now, you need a lawyer, and I'm the only son of a bitch willing to stand beside you."
Simeon nodded slightly. At 8:30, he was transferred to the courthouse and hustled up the rear stairs to the main courtroom, where he entered the temporary domain of the Honorable Percy Bullard, County Court Judge. His own courtroom was down the hall and quite small, so he preferred to use the big room when it was vacant, which was at least half the time. He had spent most of his 16 years on the bench handling minor civil disputes and lighter felonies, but occasionally he was called upon to process and speed along a more serious case. With the county in mourning and tensions high, he decided to haul in Lang, rough him up a bit, and let folks know that the wheels of justice were turning. Word had spread quickly, and there were spectators in the courtroom. At 9 a.m. sharp, Simeon was led in, and a guiltier defendant had never been seen. His face was a mess. His Orange County jail overalls were too big and bloodstained. He was handcuffed behind his back, and the bailiffs took their sweet time freeing him. Judge Bullard looked at him and said,
"State versus Simeon Lang. Over here."
He pointed to a spot in front of the bench. Simeon shuffled over, glancing around nervously, as if he might get shot from behind. Arthur Welch stood beside him, while somehow managing to keep his distance.
"You are Simeon Lang?" Judge Bullard asked.
Simeon nodded.
"Speak up."
"I am."
"Thanks. And you are?"
"Your Honor, my name is Arthur Welch, and I practice law over in Clarksdale. I'm here to represent Mr. Lang."
Bullard looked at him as if to say, "What the hell for?" Instead, he asked Simeon,
"Mr. Lang, is Mr. Welch your lawyer?"
"He is."
"Okay. Now, Mr. Lang, you have been charged with 2 counts of vehicular homicide and 1 count of driving under the influence. How do you plead?"
"Not guilty,"
No surprise there. I'll set a preliminary hearing in about 30 days. Mr. Welch, you will be notified by my clerk. I assume you'd like to discuss bail.
As if reading from a script, Welch said,
Yes, Your Honor, we would like to request a reasonable bail at this time. Mr. Lang has a wife and family here in the county and has lived here his entire life. He is not a risk to flee and has assured me, and will assure you, that he always shows up in court when required to. Thank you. Bail is hereby set at $2 million, $1 million for each count of vehicular homicide. Anything else, Mr. Welch?
No, Your Honor.
Very well. Mr. Lang, you are remanded to the custody of the Ford County Sheriff until you make bail or are called for by this court.
He tapped his gavel lightly and winked at Welch. Simeon was re-handcuffed and taken from the courtroom. Welch followed him, and outside, under the rear terrace, exactly where the criminal defendants were always photographed when they were newsworthy enough to be photographed, Dumas Lee clicked away and got plenty of shots of Lang and his lawyer. Later, he chatted with Welch, who had little to report but was nonetheless quite willing to talk. He was completely vague on his involvement in a case 2 hours from home. Welch had been rolled out of bed at 5 that morning with a profane phone call from Harry Rex Vonner, an old roommate from law school. Welch had handled 2 of Harry Rex's divorces, and Harry Rex had handled 2 of Welch's, and they owed each other so many favors and debts and IOUs that keeping score was impossible. Harry Rex needed him instantly in Clanton, and Welch, cursing for 2 hours, made the drive. He had no plans to represent Simeon Lang beyond the indictment and would punt the case in a month or so. As Harry Rex explained, in some of the most colorful and abusive language imaginable, it was important for the local folks to see and realize that Simeon Lang was not represented by Jake Brigance, but rather by some scumbag they'd never heard of. Welch understood perfectly. It was another clear example of what was never taught in law school. It was early on Friday afternoon. The weather was cold and damp, and Jake was suffering through the weekly ritual of trying to tie up some of the week's loose ends so they wouldn't grow and fester and ruin his Monday. Among his many unwritten but nonetheless serious rules was one that required him to return every phone call by noon Friday. He preferred to avoid most of his phone calls, but that was not possible. Returning them was easy to put off. They often slid from one work day to the next, but he was determined not to drag them through the weekend. Another rule forbade him to take worthless cases that would pay little or nothing and turn his obnoxious clients into people he could choke. But, like every other lawyer, he routinely said yes to some deadbeat whose mother taught Jake in the 4th grade, or whose uncle knew his father, or the broke widow from church who couldn't afford a lawyer but couldn't live without one. Invariably, these matters turned into fish files, the ones that grew fouler the longer they sat in a corner, untouched. Every lawyer had them. Every lawyer hated them. Every lawyer swore he would never take another. You could almost smell them the first time the client walked in the door. Freedom for Jake would be an office free from fish files, and he still approached every new year with the determination to say no to the deadbeats. Years ago, Lucian had said repeatedly, "It's not the cases you take that make you, it's the cases you don't take. Just say no." Nonetheless, his special drawer for fish files was depressingly full, and every Friday afternoon he stared at them and cursed himself. Without knocking, Portia walked into his office, obviously upset. She was patting her chest as if she couldn't breathe. "There's a man here," she said almost in a whisper, because she couldn't speak any louder. "Are you okay?" he asked, once again tossing aside a fish file. She shook her head rapidly.
"No, it's Mr. Roston, the boy's father."
"What?" Jake said as he bolted to his feet. She kept patting her chest.
"He wants to see you."
"Why?"
"Please, Jake, don't tell him who I am."
They stared at each other for a second, neither with a clue.
"Okay, okay.
Put him in the conference room. I'll be down in a minute." Jeff Roston was not much older than Jake, but under the circumstances, he was a very old man. He sat with his hands together and his shoulders sagging, as if burdened by an enormous weight. He wore heavily starched khakis and a navy blazer, and looked more like a casual preppy than a man who grew soybeans. He also wore the face of a father in the midst of an unspeakable nightmare. He rose, and they shook hands, and Jake said, "I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Roston."
"Thank you.
Let's go with Jeff and Jake, okay?"
"Sure."
Jake sat beside him along one side of the table, and they faced each other. After an awkward pause, Jake said,
"I can't imagine what you're going through."
"No, you can't,"
he said softly and slowly, each word laden with grief.
"I can't either. I think we're just sort of sleepwalking, you know? Just going through the motions. Trying to survive this hour so we can deal with the next one. We're praying for time. Praying for the days to turn into weeks and then months. And then maybe one day, years from now, the nightmare will be over and we can manage the pain and the sorrow. But at the same time, we know that'll never happen.
You're not supposed to bury your kids, Jake. It's just not the natural course of things."
Jake nodded along, unable to add anything thoughtful or intelligent or helpful. What do you say to a father whose two sons were now lying in caskets waiting for their funeral?
"I can't begin to comprehend," Jake said.
His initial reaction was, "What does he want?" And now, minutes later, Jake was still wondering. "The service is tomorrow," Jake said after a long, heavy pause.
"That's right. Another nightmare."
Jeff's eyes were red and weary, and proof he had not slept in days. He could not maintain a direct stare, but chose instead to look down at his knees. He gently tapped all 10 fingers together, as if in deep meditation. He finally said,
"We received a very nice note from Letty Lang. It was hand-delivered by Sheriff Walls, who, I must say, has been wonderful. He said the two of you are friends."
Jake nodded, listened, offered nothing. Jeff continued,
"The note was heartfelt and conveyed the family's sense of grief and guilt. It meant a lot to Evelyn and me. We could tell that Letty is a fine Christian lady who's horrified at what her husband did. Could you please thank her for us?"
"Of course."
He again stared at his knees, tapped his fingertips, breathed slowly as if even that was painful. Then he said,
"I want you to tell him something else, Jake, if you don't mind. Something I'd like for you to pass along to Letty and her family, even to her husband."
"Sure, anything. What would Jake not do for such a grief-stricken father?"
"Are you a Christian, Jake?"
"I am. Sometimes more of one than others,
but I'm trying. I thought so. In the 6th chapter of the Gospel of Luke, Jesus teaches the importance of forgiveness. He knows we're human, and our natural tendency is to seek revenge, to strike back, to condemn those who hurt us. But this is wrong. We're supposed to forgive, always. So I'd like for you to tell Letty and her family, and especially her husband, that Evelyn and I forgive Simeon for what he did. We've prayed about this. We've spent time with our minister. And we cannot allow ourselves to live the rest of our days filled with hatred and ill will. We forgive him, Jake. Can you tell them? Jake was too stunned to respond. He was aware that his jaw had dropped slightly, that his mouth was open, and that he was looking at Jeff Rosten in disbelief. But for a few seconds, he couldn't adjust. How could you possibly humanly forgive a drunk who slaughtered your 2 sons less than 72 hours earlier? He thought of Hannah and the almost incomprehensible visual of her in a coffin. He would scream for bloody revenge. Finally, he managed to nod. Yes, I will tell them. Rosten said, when we bury Kyle and Beau tomorrow, when we say goodbye, we will do so with complete love and forgiveness. There's no room for hatred, Jake. Jake swallowed hard and said, that black girl out there is Letty's daughter, Simeon's daughter. She works for me. Why don't you tell her? Without a word, Jeff Rosten rose and walked to the door. He opened it, and with Jake following, he stepped into the reception area and looked at Portia. So you're Simeon Lang's daughter, he said. And she almost flinched. Slowly she stood and faced him and said, yes, sir. Your mother sent me a very nice note. Please thank her. I will. Yes. Thanks, she said nervously. And will you tell your father that my wife Evelyn and I forgive him for what happened? Portia cupped her right hand over her mouth as her eyes suddenly moistened. Rosten took a step closer and gently hugged her. Then he abruptly stepped back, said again, we forgive him, and walked out the front door without another word. They stared at the door long after he left. They were speechless, overwhelmed. Finally, Jake said, let's lock up and go home. Chapter 31. The effort to validate the handwritten will of Seth Hubbard continued to unravel late Sunday morning, though Jake and its proponents had no way of knowing it. Randall Clapp was sniffing around the town of Dilwyn, in extreme South Georgia, some 6 miles from the Florida line, when he finally found a black woman he'd been tracking for a week. Her name was Julina Kidd, aged 39, a divorced mother of 2. 5 years earlier, Julina worked in a large furniture factory near Thomasville, Georgia. She was a clerk in payroll, earned $15,000 a year, and was surprised to hear one day that the company had been bought by a faceless corporation with an Alabama domicile. Not long afterward, the new owner, a Mr. Hubbard, showed up and said hello. 1 month later, Julina was fired. 1 week after that, she filed a sexual harassment complaint with Equal Employment. The complaint was dismissed 3 weeks after it was filed. Her lawyer in Valdosta would not discuss the case with Clapp, said he'd lost contact with Julina and had no idea where she was. When Clapp found her, she was living in subsidized housing with her 2 teenagers and a younger sister, and she was working part-time for an oil jobber. Initially, she had little interest in talking to an unknown white man. Clapp, though, did this for a living and was adept at extracting information. He offered her $200 in cash, plus lunch, for 1 hour of her time, and direct answers to his questions. They met at a truck stop and ordered the special, baked chicken. Clapp, a simmering racist who would never be tempted to chase a black woman, struggled to control his thoughts. This one was a knockout. Beautiful dark skin with a touch of cream, hazel eyes that penetrated to the core, high African cheekbones, perfect teeth that revealed an easy, seductive smile. She was reserved, and her eyebrows were perpetually arched, as if she suspected every word he uttered. He didn't tell her much, not at first anyway. He said he was involved in some high-powered litigation with Seth Hubbard on the other side, and he knew they had a history. Yes, he was digging for dirt. She had it. Seth had come on to her like an 18-year-old sailor on shore leave. At the time, she was 34 and in the late stages of a bad divorce. She was fragile and frightened about her future. She had no interest in a 66-year-old white man who smelled like an ashtray, regardless of how many companies he owned. But he was persistent and spent a lot of his time at the Thomasville factory. He gave her a substantial raise and moved her to a desk near his office. He fired the old secretary and appointed Julina as his executive assistant. She could not type. He owned two furniture factories in Mexico and needed to visit them. He arranged for Julina to obtain a passport and asked her if she wanted to accompany him. She took it more as a demand than an invitation. But she had never left the country and was mildly intrigued by the notion of seeing a bit of the world, even though she knew a compromise would be involved.
"I doubt if Seth was the first white man to chase you," Clapp said.
She smiled slightly, nodded her head, and said,
"No, it does happen."
Again, Clapp tried to control his thoughts. Why was she still single and living in a subsidized apartment? Any woman, black or white, with her looks and figure, could parlay them into a much better life. Her first trip on an airplane was to Mexico City. They checked into a luxury hotel, two adjoining rooms. The dreaded knock on her door came that night, and she opened it. Afterward, lying in bed with him, she was disgusted by what she had done. Sex for money. At the moment, she was nothing but a prostitute. She bit her tongue, though, and as soon as he disappeared the next day, she took a cab to the airport. When he returned a week later, she was fired on the spot and escorted out of the office by an armed guard. She hired a lawyer who slapped a sexual harassment claim on Seth, whose own lawyer was horrified by the facts. They quickly capitulated and wanted to settle. After some haggling, Seth agreed to a lump sum payment of $125,000 in a confidential deal. Her lawyer kept $25,000, and she had been living off the rest. She wasn't supposed to reveal that to anyone, but what the hell? It had been 5 years.
"Don't worry, Seth's dead," Clapp said,
then told her the rest of the story. She listened as she chewed the elastic chicken and washed it down with sugared iced tea. She had no feelings for Seth and did not pretend to. She had practically forgotten about the old man.
"Did he ever say anything about preferring black women?"
"He said he didn't discriminate," she said, slower now. "He said I wasn't the first black one."
"When did he say these things?"
"Pillow talk, you know."
I'm not getting involved in a lawsuit.
Didn't say you were, Clapp tried to reassure her. But she was even more careful. Clapp knew he had once again stumbled onto something huge, but played it cool. But I'm sure the lawyers I work for would be willing to pay for your testimony.
Is that legal?
Of course it's legal. Lawyers pay for testimony all the time. Every expert charges a fortune. Plus, they fly you up there and cover your expenses.
How much?
Don't know. But we can talk about it later. Can I ask you something that's, well, rather delicate?
Oh, why not? What have we not discussed?
When you were with Seth, how was he? Know what I mean? He was 66 then, and he hired this black housekeeper a couple of years later. This was long before he got sick. The old boy was getting on in years, but sounds like he was fairly frisky, you know?
He was all right. I mean, for a man his age, he was pretty good.
She said this as though she had had many, and of all ages.
I got the impression he just wanted to hole up in the room and screw for a week. That's kind of impressive for an old guy, black or white.
Wade Lanier was having a beer in the men's grill at the country club when Clapp tracked him down. He teed off every Sunday morning at precisely 7:45 with the same three pals, played 18 holes, usually won more money than he lost, then drank beer for a couple of hours over poker. He quickly forgot about the cards and the beer and made Clapp repeat every word of his conversation with Julina Kidd. Most of what she said would not be admissible in court. However, the fact that she could take the stand, let the jury absorb her ethnicity, and chat about her claim for sexual harassment at the hands of Seth Hubbard would sway any white jury to believe the old guy and Letty were probably doing business. They would believe that Letty had gotten as close as humanly possible, and she had influenced him. She had used her body to work her way into his will. Lanier couldn't prove it by a preponderance of evidence, but he could certainly imply it in a powerful way. He left the country club and drove to his office. Early Monday morning, Ian and Ramona Defoe drove 3 hours from Jackson to Memphis and had a late breakfast with Herschel. Their relationship had deteriorated, and it was time to patch things up, or that's what Ramona said anyway. They were on the same side. It was foolish for them to bicker and distrust one another. They met at a pancake house, and after the usual efforts at reconciliation, Ian launched into a strong-armed plea for Herschel to ditch Stillman Rush and his firm. His lawyer, Wade Lanier, was far more experienced and, frankly, was worried that Rush would be a hindrance at trial. He was a pretty boy, too showy, cocky, and likely to alienate the jury. Lanier had watched him closely now for over 4 months and did not like what he saw. There was a big ego and not much talent. Trials can be won or lost by the arrogance of a lawyer, and Wade Lanier was worried sick. He was even threatening to bail out. And there was more. As evidence of the inequality of their lawyers, Ian revealed the story of the other will and its attempted bequest of $50,000 to Letty. He did not name names because he didn't want Stillman Rush to screw up things. Herschel was stunned, but also thrilled. But wait, it gets better. Now Wade Lanier had found a black woman who sued Seth for sexual harassment. Look at what my lawyer is doing and compare it to yours. Your boy is not in the game, Herschel. Lanier understands guerrilla warfare. Your lawyer is a Boy Scout. Let's join forces here. Lanier even has a deal to offer. If we come together, get rid of Rush, and allow Lanier to represent both of us, he'll cut his fee to 25% of any settlement. He has a strategy to force a settlement, especially in light of what his chief investigator is digging up. He'll pick the right moment and spring it all on Jake Brigance, who'll crack under the pressure. We can have the money within a few months. Herschel held his ground for a while, but eventually agreed to drive to Jackson and meet with Lanier in secret. Simeon Lang was finishing Monday's dinner of pork and beans from a can and four slices of stale white bread when the jailer appeared and stuck a package through the bars.
"Happy reading," he said, and walked away.
It was from the law offices of Harry Rex Vonner. Inside was a letter from the lawyer addressed to Simeon, care of the Ford County Jail, and the letter tersely announced to Simeon that what followed was a complaint for divorce. He had 30 days to respond. He read it slowly. What was the hurry? Habitual, cruel, and inhuman treatment. Adultery? Desertion? Physical abuse? Page after page of allegations, some of them wild, some of them true. What difference did it make? He had killed two boys and was headed to Parchman for a long time. His life was over. Letty needed someone else. She hadn't been to see him since they locked him up, and he doubted she would ever visit. Not here, not in Parchman. Portia had stopped by to say hello, but didn't hang around too long.
"What are you reading?"
asked Denny from the top bunk. Denny was his new cellmate, who had been caught driving a stolen car. Simeon was already tired of him. He preferred living alone, though at times it was almost pleasant having someone to talk to.
"My wife just filed for divorce," he said. "Lucky you. I've had two of them already. They get kind of crazy when you're in jail." "If you say so." "You ever had a restraining order?"
"No, but my brother did. Bitch convinced a judge he was dangerous, which he was, and a judge told him to stay away from the house and keep his distance in public. Didn't bother him. Killed her anyway."
"Your brother killed his wife?" "Yep, but she had it coming. It was justifiable homicide, but the jury didn't exactly see it that way. Found him guilty of second degree."
"Where is he?"
"Angola, Louisiana, 20 years.
"That's about what you'll get, according to my lawyer."
"Your lawyer?"
"Yeah. I asked him this afternoon when I saw him. He knows about your case. Said the whole town is talking about it. Said folks are really upset. Said your wife's about to get rich from this big wheel contest, but your ass will be locked away for the next 20 years. By the time you get out, all the money will be gone, what with all the new friends she's got."
"That true?"
"Ask your lawyer." "How'd your wife get herself into that old man's will like that?"
"Said he left behind $20 million or so."
"That true?"
"Ask your lawyer."
"I'll do that. Didn't mean to piss you off or anything."
"I ain't pissed. Just don't want to talk about it, okay?"
"You got it, man."
Denny picked up his paperback and started reading. Simeon stretched out on the bottom bunk and went back to page one. In 20 years, he would be 66. Letty would have another husband and a much better life. She would have the children and grandchildren and probably great-grandchildren, and he would have nothing. He wouldn't fight the divorce. She could have it all. Maybe he could see Marvis in prison. Chapter 32. 8 days after the Roston tragedy, And just as it was beginning to wind down and folks were discussing other matters, it bolted back onto center stage in the weekly edition of the Ford County Times. On the front page, under a bold headline, "County Mourns Loss of Rostin Brothers," were large class photos of Kyle and Beau. Below it and beneath the fold were photos of their wrecked car, their coffins being carried out of their church, and their classmates holding candles at a vigil outside Clanton High School. Dumas Lee had missed little. His stories were long and detailed. On page 2 was a large photo of Simeon Lang, his face ominously bandaged, leaving the courthouse in handcuffs the previous Thursday with his attorney of record, Mr. Arthur Welch of Clarksdale. The story that accompanied the photo made no mention of Jake Brigance, primarily because Jake had threatened Dumas and the newspaper with a libel suit if it even remotely implied that he represented Simeon. There was mention of the old but still pending DUI charge from the previous October, but Dumas did not pursue it, or imply that it had been improperly handled. He was terrified of litigation, and usually backed down quickly. The two obituaries were lengthy and heartbreaking. There was a story from the high school with glowing comments from classmates and teachers. There was one from the accident scene, with Ozzie providing the details. The eyewitness had a lot to say and got his photo in the newspaper. The parents were silent. An uncle asked that their privacy be respected. Jake had read every word by 7 a.m. and felt exhausted. He skipped the coffee shop because he was tired of the endless prattling about the tragedy. He kissed Carla goodbye at 7:30 and went to the office, hoping for a return to his normal routine. His goal was to spend most of the day working on cases other than Hubbard. He had a handful of clients in real need of some attention. Just after 8 o'clock, Stillman Rush called with the news that he had just been fired by Herschel Hubbard. Jake listened thoughtfully. On the one hand, he was delighted to see Stillman hit the back door because he really didn't care for the guy. But on the other hand, he was bothered by Wade Lanier's powers of manipulation. In his only other major trial, that of Carl Lee Haley, Jake had gone toe-to-toe with Rufus Buckley, then an accomplished district attorney. And while Buckley was quite skilled in the courtroom and smooth on his feet, he was not overly bright, not a crafty manipulator or a clever schemer. Not at all like Wade Lanier, who seemed to be always one step ahead. Jake was convinced Lanier would do anything. Lie, cheat, steal, cover up, whatever it took to win at trial. And he had the experience, quick wit, and bag of tricks to do so. Jake wanted Stillman in the courtroom, bungling things and strutting in front of the jury. Jake sounded sufficiently sad to say goodbye, but forgot about the call within the hour. Portia needed reassuring. They had fallen into the habit of having a morning coffee around 8:30, always in Jake's office. The family had received 4 threatening calls in the days after the accident, but now the calls seemed to have stopped. A deputy still hung around the house, sitting in the driveway, checking the rear door at night, and the family was feeling safer. The Rostons had handled themselves with such grace and courage that the raw feelings had been contained, at least for now. However, if Simeon decided he wanted a trial, then the entire nightmare would be replayed. Portia, Letty, and the rest of the family were worried about the spectacle of a trial, of having to face the Rostin family in court. Jake doubted that would ever happen, and if it did, it would be at least a year away. For 3 months, He had been prodding Letty to get a job, any job. It would be important at trial for the jurors to know she was working and trying to support her family, not retired at 47 and expecting the windfall. But no white homemaker would hire her as a housekeeper, not with her baggage and controversies. She was too old for the fast food joints, too black for anyone's office staff.
"Mama got a job," Portia said proudly.
"Excellent. Where?"
"The Methodist Church. She'll clean their preschool 3 days a week. Minimum wage, but that's all she can find right now."
"Is she happy?"
"She filed for divorce 2 days ago, Jake. And her last name is pretty toxic around here. She has a son in prison, a house full of deadbeat relatives, a 21-year-old daughter with two unwanted kids. Life's pretty tough for my mom. A job that pays $3.50 an hour is not likely to bring much happiness."
"Sorry I asked." They were on his balcony, outside where the air was brisk but not too cold. Jake had a million things on his mind, and he had already had a gallon of coffee.
"You remember Charlie Pardue? My so-called cousin from Chicago?" she asked. "Met him at Claude's a couple of months ago?"
"Sure. You called him a shyster who wants money for a new funeral home."
"Yep. We've been talking on the phone. And he's found a relative over near Birmingham, an old guy in a nursing home, last name of Rhines. He thinks this guy could be the link."
"But Pardue is after money, right?"
"They're all after money. Anyway, I'm thinking about driving over this Saturday to find the old guy and ask him some questions."
"Is he a Rhines?"
"Yes, Boaz Rhines."
"Okay. Have you told Lucian?"
"I have, and he thinks it's worth the effort."
"Saturday's your day off. I'm not in charge."
"Just wanted you to know. And there's something else, Jake. Lucian told me the county keeps some of the ancient courthouse records at Burley, the old black school."
"Yes, that's true. I went there once looking for an old file. Didn't find it. The county stores a lot of junk there."
"How far back do the records go?"
Jake thought for a moment. His phone rang in the distance. Finally, he said, "The land records are still in the courthouse because they get used, but a lot of stuff is basically worthless. Marriage and divorce records, birth and death records, lawsuits, judgments, and so on. Most of it should be tossed out, but no one wants to destroy court documents, not even from 100 years ago. I heard once there are trial transcripts dating back to before the Civil War, all handwritten. Interesting, but of little value today. Too bad the fire didn't destroy it all."
"When was the fire?"
"Every courthouse burns at one time or another. Ours was severely damaged in 1948. A lot of records were lost."
"Can I dig through the old files?"
"Why? It's a waste."
"Because I love the legal history, Jake. I've spent hours in the courthouse reading old court files and land records. You can learn a ton about a place and its people. Did you know that in 1915 they hung a man in front of the courthouse 1 month after his trial? He robbed Security Bank, shot a man but didn't really hurt him, made off with $200, then got caught. They tried him on the spot, then strung him up."
"That's pretty efficient. I guess they didn't worry about overcrowded prisons."
"Or congested dockets. Anyway, I'm fascinated with this stuff. I've read an old will from 1847 where some white guy gave away his slaves, talked about how much he loved and treasured them, then gave them away like horses and cows."
"Sounds depressing. You'll never find a brigand who owned a slave. We were lucky to have a cow."
"Anyway, I need written permission from a member of the bar to get into the old files. County rule."
"Done. Just do it after hours. You still digging for your roots?"
"Sure. I'm looking everywhere. The Rhineses abruptly left this county in 1930 without a trace, without a clue. And I want to know why.
Lunch in the rear of Bates Grocery was a selection of four vegetables chosen at random from a collection of 10 pots and skillets simmering on a large gas stove. Mrs. Bates herself pointed, dipped, served, and commented as she loaded the plates and handed them over, while Mr. Bates punched the cash register and collected $3.50, iced tea included, with cornbread. Jake and Harry Rex made the drive out once a month when they needed to eat and talk without being overheard. It was a rural crowd, farmers and farm workers, with a pulpwood cutter sometimes thrown in for balance. All white. Blacks would be served without incident, but that had yet to happen. Blacks shopped up front in the grocery. In fact, Tonya Haley had bought a sack of groceries there and was walking the mile back to her home when she was abducted 3 years earlier. The two lawyers huddled around a small table as far away as possible from the others. The table rocked, and the ancient floor squeaked, and just above them, a rickety fan spun unevenly, though it was still wintertime, and the entire building was drafty. In another corner, a pot-bellied stove radiated a thick, pungent heat that kept the narrow room comfortable. After a few bites, Harry Rex said,
"Dumas did a good job, for him anyway. That boy loves a good car wreck as much as any lawyer."
I had to threaten him. But yes, he did us no harm. No more than was already done. Thanks for hauling in Arthur Welch for a cameo.
He's an idiot, but my kind of idiot. The stories we could tell. We once spent 2 nights in a county jail when we were supposed to be in law school. Almost got kicked out.
Jake knew better than to take the plunge, but couldn't help himself. Why were you in jail? Harry Rex shoveled in a load of collard greens and began.
Well, we'd been to New Orleans for a long weekend, and we were trying to get back to Ole Miss. I was driving, drinking, and somewhere down in Pike County we got lost. Saw blue lights, and I said, "Shit, Welch, you got to take the wheel. Here come the cops, and I'm drunk." Welch said, "I'm drunk too, big ass. You on your own." But we were in his car, and I knew for a fact he was not as drunk as I was. I said, "Hey, Welch, you ain't had but a couple of beers. I'm stopping this thing right now, and you get your ass over here."